Cocktail College is brought to you by Ketel One Vodka. Certain brands out there, certain vodka brands, want you to believe that these spirits should be flavorless and odorless. And they achieve this profile through multiple runs of distillation in column stills. They actually celebrate this thing. They market it. But you're a discerning drinker, Cocktail College listener, aren't you? And you know that vodka should have character, should have subtle character. And that arrives from the base ingredient and the production technique. In the case of Ketel One, we're talking about a wheat base made using a blend or a mix of pot and column still distillation. And what you get there is character, but subtle character, so that it's going to enhance but never overpower your favorite vodka cocktails, your martinis, your cosmos. Ketel One stands so firmly behind this production technique that on every single bottle, there's an invitation for you, the drinker, to visit them at their Netherlands distillery. And hey, why wouldn't they? They've only got 330 years family distilling experience right there. So it's understandable that they back themselves. And you should back them too, listener. You know what you should do? You should pick up a bottle and head over to KettleOne.com to learn more. Hey, this is Tim McCurdy, and welcome to VinePair's Cocktail College, a weekly deep dive into classic cocktails that goes beyond the recipe with America's best bartenders.
If you're an incredible flair bartender, but you have no cocktail knowledge and no speed, you're a shit bartender. And we all know that. None of us think that we're like the best because we can flip a few bottles. I mean, that's what I pride myself on, is like, I might not be the best flair bartender in the world, but I'm pretty good at what I do.
Cocktail folks like to put the Professor Jerry Thomas on a pedestal, and with good reason. The man they call the father of American mixology, or words to those effect, contributed just as much to the craft as any other person in history. But you know what they don't often call out? His contributions to the discipline of flair bartending. When you mention those words, minds sooner wander to a certain movie from the late 80s and casual dining chains. And we'll get into all of those today too, as we explore the history, styles, community, and craft of flair bartending. We're doing so right here in the studio with Lindsay Palumbo, a certified flair bartender, instructor, and competitor who plies her trade at the Circo Hotel and Casino on Las Vegas's Fremont Street. Folks, it's Blue Blazers, TGI Fridays, and a certain actor with the initials TC. And it's all right here on the Cocktail College podcast. Joining us live today, all the way from the Old Strip in Las Vegas, Lindsay Palumbo. Lindsay, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm super excited.
Enjoying your time in New York City?
Yes, I love New York City. I would consider moving here if it wasn't for the humidity and the snow.
And the terrible rain that we've been enjoying recently, but not enjoying. Don't get too much of that out in Las Vegas. I've never been. I've always wanted to go.
You've never been? Oh, you got to come visit. I love the weather out there. Like, there's 2 months where the heat is very excessive, but the rest of the year, like, yeah, we get cold at nighttime, winter, I mean, day and nighttime, but I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, so I'm used to, like, the snow and stuff. For me, like, the rainy days, I love them out there, and we do get windy sometimes. We just had the biggest windstorm in history since, like, I don't know the year. But I love the weather out there. It's
global
great.
Global warming, climate change. It's real, people.
It gotta is real. Love it.
Lindsay, the listeners already know, but you're here, of course, to chat with us about flair bartending. Fascinating topic. I can't wait to get into it. But before we go deep on that, I want to know a little bit what it's like to be part of the flair bartending community, because it's a community, I'll be honest, that I'm not too familiar with myself and don't know too many folks within that. So why don't you tell us about that today?
It's absolutely like its own community. Like, I have always viewed our industry, like bartenders, hospitality, all that. Like, we definitely have our own, but this is like a specific like subcategory or sub industry. And the community it's very tight, and not just in Vegas, but countrywide and international. Like, I could go to so many different countries and at least know someone by association there. Maybe we did a competition or just social media. People come up to me like, oh, hey. And I'm like, oh, I know you. We don't know each other. But it's a very small but way bigger community than you'd think. Like, even when I first moved out there, I didn't know it was this whole thing. And it's really incredible, because in Vegas alone, like, we obviously all know each other. We all have worked together at one point, and the guys that have been there for 20 plus years doing it, they opened the first Flair establishment together. Fast forward 20 years, they're working at a new spot that we all opened together. So it's really incredible, and good and bad things. Like, everyone kind of knows each other's business. And if you keep something private, people are like, why aren't you telling everyone? Like, we should all know that about you. Or like, there's like a shock factor because we just feel like we know so much about each other's lives. So it's definitely a good thing. It's a great feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I know I've heard so many stories of people that have all lived together at one point because they all moved there. Let's go do this and be Flair bartenders. And even when I first came out there, people that I didn't even know were like, yeah, we're practicing the garage. Come over. We'll teach you some stuff. And it's awesome because you come in there with a good reputation and you can immerse yourself in the community and everyone helps each other. It's great. And
that's cool.
Once you burn a bridge, it's a little tougher because we all help people get hired. I've gotten people jobs or recommendations, even bar backing, and then I teach them on the job. So it's a really nice sense of community.
I love that. That's
overall,
so cool to hear.
Positive things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe one of those where perhaps not quite like the rest of the industry or the rest of the greater industries may be changing, but I think you'd maybe mentioned before that remains something of a male-dominated community for now. Is that changing? Or you yourself, how's that experience been?
So it's definitely a positive experience. I think it's the female experience in this world is different. And that doesn't necessarily mean in a negative way. Are there negatives? Of course. But mm-hmm. there's so many positives too. They kind of go hand in hand. Like the negative would be everyone thinks that you got something or earned something or was given a job, a opportunity only because you're a girl. And it's like, yeah, sometimes. But you have to take it with a grain of salt. Like I've won categories and competitions for best female. I was the only female. And people will look at you like that and it's like they'll discredit that. But at the same time, I used to take it to heart. And I'm like, yeah, but like at the same time, I had to remind myself, I am the only one going up there. Like maybe, some credit was due. Not that that makes me better. I skill set wise, like, yeah, there's some guys that I can't even come close to competing with. But it's nice to have that recognition. But on the other hand, people are like, well, I thought you wanted to be not viewed as just a female Flair bartender. So it is counterintuitive, I guess, because I'm like, yeah, but we're all equal. And then I'm like, but like, we're not. I don't, it's,
yeah, well, no,
it's
I
hard
think,
to explain.
I think
honestly.
That's worth pointing out, though, because again, like if an industry traditionally skews more one way or another, then if you're from the minority there, then it's going to be harder to get opportunities at first, right? Or maybe harder to prove your quality, or people might be more suspicious of that. But I think the competition you touch upon there is a great way for us to talk about now the fact that, yeah, we're covering Flair bartending today, but Flair bartending is actually maybe two different disciplines here.
It has a lot of disciplines into it. There's some people that kind of just fell into it. There's people like myself who moved to Vegas to be a Flair bartender. And there's some people that are like, oh, no interest in doing competitions. I like doing it for work. Or there's people that only do it at their job. I mean, the training at home takes, like, that's inevitable. You're always going to have to do that. Once you get your status and your job, whether you choose to continue to grow, that's on you. And you don't have to. We do, like, those places in Vegas, we do something called level tests. And it's like a yearly or twice a year thing where you have to go in and do five different testing categories. And that's like a time that a lot of people will be like back to the practice room just to brush up on that, which is honestly a good thing that they do make us do it because, it gets people excited again, make sure that we're staying on our stuff. And some people only do it for that.
Mm-hmm.
Totally cool. And then you have people that train relentlessly, like all the time, no off season, even if there's no competition coming up, they're training because they're ready. And then there's people like me. So when I first moved to Vegas, it was a minimum of 4 to 10 hours in the practice room every day. And I wasn't working as much then, but I kind of hit a place where I was comfortable, but I never really stopped competing. But like the amount of time I spent in there once I got, full-time employment and more extracurriculars in my life, now I'm kind of in the place where I'm training, those hours dedicated and training harder to upgrade my moves or smooth something out when there is something. But because I stay doing things, like I don't just do the level tests, I do competitions, I do shows, I do a lot of private events all around Vegas, and I've had some like TV and film opportunities. So even though I'm not training every, even when there's nothing coming up, I always tend to have something coming up. So
mm-hmm.
it stays fresh in my mind and relevant to me for training purposes.
Yeah. And so I guess broadly speaking, we could maybe break that down or draw an invisible line between maybe, and of course there's crossover there, right? You mentioned it, that an incredible amount of training goes into this, but you can draw this line where you say, one is working flair bartending in terms of like whether you're behind a bar or doing a private event. Yep. And another would be competition, which is competitive, which again involves all of the same work and skills. But yeah, there's a structure to that, and that there's an international these days, global
absolutely
circuit for that.
Yeah,
I think a lot of people listening might not realize that the history of flair bartending goes much deeper than, say, a very popular movie that we're going to get into.
I already know.
Might suggest, and I'm sorry, we don't want to be cliched here, but it's going to be inevitable.
Absolutely.
But also, Lindsay, I know you're taking part in a documentary, or you've taken part in a documentary, and part of that was exploring the history of this discipline.
Yeah.
And that history might lead us all the way back to Mr. Jerry Thomas himself. Is that true?
Yeah. Jerry Thomas, you know, I learned about him early on in my, you know, industry years. And I think, like, you know, the Blue Blazer, that's classic. And that's, I mean, that's flair, you know, whatever form
full
you want to call
flair.
It. Yeah. Like, he didn't have to toss a cocktail that many, whatever. Maybe he did, but... Mm-hmm.
And for those who maybe don't know that drink, can you describe its preparation for us here?
Yeah, the Blue Blazer, I know from my perspective, like, it's a flaming cocktail, so it's on fire, and he's doing the cocktail throwing while it's on fire. I think it's super cool, and I think that was probably, like, the first, like, showmanship bartending style, which is mm-hmm. super cool to me. I've never tasted one. I don't think I would like that very much. I'm not more of a smoky cocktail kind of gal, but, yeah, and, you know, Jerry Thomas and the Blue Blazer, it's a staple in not only, like, just bartending, mixology, flair, it's just, you know, just in general in this industry, it's very notable.
Yeah, and it's a classic, and I think probably most folks would agree that flaming aspect of it is there for show and for theater. It doesn't really influence the drink's flavor profile too much, but,
yeah.
You know, we're talking about someone who many people regard and put on this pedestal as one of the most important figures within the history of cocktails and mixology, so...
Yeah.
I always think it's worth pointing those things out when
yeah.
on this show we like to maybe try and break down pretense and things like that and stuffy attitudes towards things and be like, actually, this thing that you think is maybe somewhat modern and we've moved past has a much longer history than people realize and involves
yeah.
figures that you look up to. So that's
a
good place to start.
I totally agree about, you know, trying to get those pretenses out of people's minds because it's easy to have. It's so easy, especially when it's like a whole different world to you. But at the end of the day, like, there's a reason why the Blue Blazer is so famous. And you really kind of have to think about that. It's like, yeah, it was unnecessary, but like, it was cool.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's anybody in the industry, hopefully, can be like, Jerry Thomas, like, what's he known for? If you were on a trivia question, and everyone knows it
mm-hmm.
for a reason.
Mm-hmm. And then another very important part of modern mixology as well that often goes underappreciated. I think we have mentioned once or twice within this show. I can't remember what episode, but
yeah.
I would say maybe the next major player or one that I want to visit from a historical standpoint is TGI Fridays. And I think impossible to overstate that chain's role within flair bartending, even to this day.
100%. And as cheesy as Fridays is, you know, and people think of flair with all the pins and stuff. And it's fair. It's a funny and relevant assumption. But yeah, TGI Fridays is, I mean, that was the beginning point of working flares and competition flair. And a lot of people I know, like, you know, they've been doing it 15, 20, 25, you know, a lot of people got their start at Fridays because people ask me all the time, like, how did you get into flair? I'm like, I stumbled into a bar in Vegas when I was 21 and was like, what the hell is that? But a lot of people are like, I worked at Fridays. They made us do this. And I thought it was cool. And that's, so Fridays has a lot to do with, you know, especially the beginning foundation of flair bartending.
Mm-hmm.
Just super, it's kind of funny, but it's interesting.
Yeah, and a couple of names to point out there as well. You know, we want to honor the people who have had a big role. I think here, and I'm reading from my notes, I don't have these off the top of my head, but I think here's John Mezcal in the Marina del Rey, California
mm-hmm.
branch, who maybe kind of sparks that interest from the higher-ups within Fridays.
Yeah.
And they say, okay, this guy's doing something different. They launch a competition in 85. That competition goes national and then global in 91. And I think it continues to this day.
Yeah, Bar Wars is still going on.
Bar Wars.
Yeah. I mean, I've never attended one, but I've seen, like, you know, I still know Flair bartenders that are Friday's bartenders because they've been doing it forever. I think the big, like, prize, it's like a propeller almost. I think it's like the, I could be wrong, but, like, whatever the prize, I'm sure there's prize money, whatever, but, like, the trophy, so to say, is, like, and I don't know why, but I think it's like a giant, like, plane propeller. I don't know. I mean, maybe don't quote me on that. But I know that's like the golden propeller. I don't know.
Like, well,
but there's,
you know,
something to do with a propeller in there.
I very much want that to be true, if only for the fact that it allows me to set up this very cheesy segue, which is that an individual who is very familiar with propellers in some of the other movies that he's acted in. I'm sorry, that is terrible. But
that was great. That was awesome.
You know, somewhere between the competition's going national in 87 and then global in 91, 1988, we see Cocktail hits the big screens.
Oh, yeah.
Tom Cruise, of course, was the person I was referencing there. But I think that's something that maybe introduces Flair to the massive mainstream audiences that might not be familiar with it.
Absolutely. And is like, I mean, I don't really have much opinion on that movie. It was a fine movie. But even like today, 2024, people of all ages are like, oh, it's, you know, you like Cocktail, or like they'll be like Tom Cruise. And I'm like, I don't do Scientology. Sorry, I said I wouldn't make that joke, but I had to. But it's so funny. But like, that is like the general public, like what they associate it with. So it is funny because I know that movie came out, what was the year?
88, I think.
88. And it's still relevant today. Like, that's, I'm sure most people haven't watched that movie since it came out that year. And they're like, Tom Cruise and Cocktail. And I'm like, you know it. That's my biggest inspiration. They're like, you were probably too young to see that. And I go, obviously I've seen it because everyone talks to me about it. I watched it when I like first started doing Flair. I'm like, I have to watch this movie. And I was like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, it shows skill set, like what Flair is in there, but it's crazy like how much Flair has evolved since then. Because I look at the moves in there, I'm like, oh, like I'm expecting, because my first exposure to Flair was, you know, watching competition videos from like the European guys and like, you know, all countries, but US and like people that I know. And I'm like, the stuff that these guys can do on stage is, it's mind bending. Like, I've already seen this exposure from the guys competing like the most prestigious competitions in the world, like Roadhouse, Flair Mania, overseas. And then I watched Tom Cruise doing a flip to pour with a bottle, and I'm like, oh.
So is that safe to say then that the quality on offer there in that movie is perhaps nowhere near where we've reached with modern standards?
Oh, it doesn't
there.
Even come remotely close to the things and like the tricks and techniques and what these people, you know, myself included, to an extent. But yeah, I mean, it totally makes sense of why that's everybody's initial association mm-hmm. to Flair bartending.
And, you know, just to also call back to that, the importance of TGI Fridays in their competitions, we have a man here, John J.B. Bandy, I want to say.
Yeah, he's the one who trained Tom Cruise and the other guy.
The other guy, who's probably perennially known as the other guy. Man,
I know his name. It's slipping my mind right now. But yeah, he's the one who trained the guys in for the movie, which is super cool. A few of us in the industry were like, well, they should remake another one.
Yes.
Put us all in it.
Well, you know, he won the TGI Fridays competition in 87, probably what sets him up. He had that big propeller.
He had the propeller.
And
it'd be so embarrassing if I just pulled that out of thin air. I think it's a thing.
If not, you can start your own competition. But you know what? They remade Top Gun, and I bloody loved Maverick. So I think we could remake Cocktail.
So Tom Cruise, if you're listening, and we know that you are, let's do it, man. Let's go in. I'll train you personally. We'll be co-stars. Because speaking of starring in movies, actually, there's a documentary that I'm in coming out, and John J.B. Bandy is we do an interview with him, which I haven't seen it yet, so I'm excited to see his perspective on it and like hearing his stories. They said the director and producer said it was a fantastic interview, so I'm excited. I'm excited to hear about that.
That's really cool. And again, you know, great to see that this person is being recognized for the work that they did and the influence that they had. And, you know, again, we just said people connect Flair with Cocktail, Cocktail with Tom Cruise and the other guy.
And that guy. We love him.
So it's good.
We love him.
It's good that JB's getting the recognition there, you know, and the influence they had on that.
And this is actually, it's the first feature film documentary, I don't know the terms, about Flair bartending. And I'm sure, I mean, I don't know, but perhaps Mr. Bandy, like, never expected to revisit that in his life again, you know, and now we're in this documentary, really highlighting like the history, the past, present, and future. Like there was kind of a fall and resurgence of flair, and like we mm-hmm. really explore that. So it's super cool that he was willing to be a part of it. I'm excited.
Well, that's another wonderful segue, because the next bullet point I had here today on topics that I wanted to discuss with mm-hmm. you is the modern state of flair bartending. And also, you know, we spoke about the fact that where your work is on the old strip, Vegas right now is just so exciting when it comes to, you know, the Sphere, the Grand Prix, but also just this influx of bars and restaurants and chefs and bartenders and whatnot.
It's never ending.
Yeah.
Too many options, I'll say. Too many.
Well, there might possibly be too many options. You're right. But what is that coexistence like, and what is the state of modern flair bartending these days? Where are we at?
So flair is very much alive and well. With Vegas, you know, there's been a lot of like bars that started off top. I mean, for example, the Rio, they had the first flair property, and that place was absolutely popping. If you look up the old like YouTube videos, they have a bar like the center main bar on whatever casino floor. They would have a huge crowd. I mean, like 4 or 5 deep, but just people watching these guys put on shows, and it was such a vibe and such an energy. That was a little bit before my time. And then there was another one called Shadow Bar at Caesars, which, again, like, it's a lot of the same people that have been in Vegas throughout, you know, these bars and since Flair even started out there. Yeah, I've heard so many cool stories, and it's like, well, these bars were so successful. Why? But, you know, those corporate bastards. I don't work for Caesars. Fuck them. but it's a thing. Like, even though currently there's still a handful of Flair bars in Vegas. And, you know, from an outside perspective, like, because I don't work there, like, we see the higher management, higher ups, like, making decisions where, like, if it's not broke, don't fix. If anything, it's probably your highest revenue bar, because, like, Vegas isn't cheap, you know, by any means. But these bartenders, like, they have so many regulars, they draw people in, and it's hard to leave these places. So we still see, like, the bigger companies, excluding my own, and I'll get into that, but kind of damaging these flair bars and making it even harder for them. Like, they keep raising their prices. They try to take out the live entertainment at Carnival Court is one of the most well-known flair bars in the country, or maybe even the world. I don't know. It's the most incredible bar, and it's the reason why I ever saw flair bartending the first time. And these bartenders are incredible. And you can see them, like, getting rid of people for no reason, or trying to take away the live music. And it's like, what are you doing? Like, they bring in so much revenue, and nobody asks the bartenders what works, even though they're on the front line. But anyway, and then on the Strip, yeah, there's still a few places, like even the Link Hotel. They used to have one or two of the bars in there that was required that you were a flair bartender. They decided to take that away, which doesn't sound like a big deal, because, yeah, if you're a flair bartender, you can still do it at work, sure. But in Vegas, it affects the seniority levels. And because this center bar was required to be flair, you had to have the level, which made you jump seniority for that bar specifically. So when they made flair not a requirement there, it brought out some people that have probably worked there for 20, 30 years, and now their seniority goes back up. And I'm sure they're fine people, but you have to consider, like, Vegas, we're union properties. So a lot of people work that job with full benefits until they retire. So you might have the guy that's been working service bar with no personality, maybe is just kind of few more years till retirement, blah, blah, blah. And then now these guys are the face and the, you know, face of these bars and the good shifts, whatever. And that's not always the case, but definitely happens. But also, one of the other, like, best flair bars out there is a Fuel Bar on the Strip. I worked there as a bar back for a few years. And it's great. It's a small, privately owned bar. So they have, like, freedoms there, and it's great. And it's, you know, no gaming, no crazy stuff. It's just, it's a nice, like, local bar feel. But it can also be super touristy, like, and that's what flair bartenders do. We draw people in, and like, they don't want to leave because they're having so much fun. They forget that they're maybe spending a little bit extra on drinks, but like,
I think that's so interesting. And so just to get this clear as well about something you were talking about earlier there. So, you know, you have this weird situation whereby the flair requirement before really did help elevate or give status to those people who, much like yourself, are practicing in their own hours, in their off time, you know, perfecting these techniques, and therefore, like, putting more effort in. And now we see a situation where, because that requirement's been taken away, then it flips to people gain seniority purely because they've stuck around and they may not have the personality or...
Exactly. And that's, like, that scenario is specific to the one property that I mentioned. And I'm glad you said that, because like transitioning to talking about Fremont Street where I work, or Old Vegas as most people refer to it. So my company, I work for Circa Resort Casino, and it's the one of the newest properties in Vegas. We opened definitely on Fremont Street back in 2020, October, which was a weird time, but
for sure.
It worked out somehow, kind of. But yeah, like, so my company, our head honcho owner, Derek Stevens, who's awesome. Like, this guy owns 3-4 properties in Vegas and knows me by first name. Like, he's the CEO, whatever the highest is, that's mm-hmm. that guy. And he's awesome. And he owns our sister properties, the D and the Golden Gate. And with Circa, the D and the Gate, they're all flare bar properties. For like the Golden Gate, it's just the outside bar. The D and Circa, it's the two inside bars and the outside bar. Everything else, there's a couple, like we have like the dancing bartenders outside that do like the frozen drinks. And we have at Circa a couple cocktail lounges, mixology lounges, which they also have to do testing too, you know, which is cool because they hire very knowledgeable people. And that's why we're super successful. But that being said, flair bartending does not by any means make you a good bartender. We all know flair bartenders at incredible skill level, but they can't hold a conversation. It mm-hmm. happens. It happens. But like when people always ask me, like for Circa, it was not an open like application. It was invite only to audition and to interview. And this is what I always like tell people, like us flair people, whatever you want to call us, like we don't think we're hot shit. We don't think we're cool. We have a hobby and we made a career out of it. Great. But why I think like our company has the right idea is because when you are a flair bartender, there's so much that goes into it. Our job is our hobby. We do this outside of work. And that just tends to breed more committed, passionate bartenders. And that's not the case with everybody. There's some not great bartenders that have the title as flair bartender. But for the most part, it's like whether it's guys that used to do competitions and don't anymore, they did the every single day in the garage, 10, 20, well, 20 hours. That's excessive. Scratch that. 20 hours a day, all of us. That's insane. But yeah, it just tends to have bartenders that this is like people do like, what do you do for fun? I'm like this because it is fun for us, you know, and training for whether it's just work or extra stuff, showcases, competitions. And that's kind of what sets us apart. And this is very specific to Vegas because, like I said, these union bartenders have been doing it 50 years. You know, they're kind of like, we're going to get, you know, they don't really care as much.
They're to collect a check, right?
Yeah, 100%. And since I've been in Vegas, I can't tell you how many times people have told me, like, you're the nicest bartender I've ever met here. And I'm like, I'm not even that nice. I'm just kidding. But yeah, and that's a huge thing with flair. And
so would you say then that those are three great criteria, and maybe you want to build upon this, but for a great working flair bartender or in the working scenario, right?
Yeah.
So it sounds like skill set, which stems from practice and ongoing practice. You mentioned service as well and hospitality, which is the name of the industry.
Mm-hmm, 100%.
And then finally, and something I want us to touch upon now, again, in the working scenario here, but it may also, I'm sure it also comes into the exhibition and whatnot and competitions, but quality of drinks. Because I think that that's something where maybe a lot of the skepticism might come from some folks where they're like, you're paying for the show. And ultimately that show might not provide you the best quality product in the glass.
That is a fair misconception. However, it's not always the case. And it, like, for example, like my bar, we don't have a cocktail menu. We don't have a plethora of like fresh ingredients and all that, or even like good like liqueurs and things to mix and make, you know, crazy interesting things with. We have basics. And there's a lot of us, like, you know, we can make all the classic cocktails, old fashioned, you know, all of them that are simple. Just the old-fashioned, that's it.
you got your martinis, your Manhattans, you know, all the for sure.
Like, there's a few things when people order, and I'm like, I don't have the stuff to make that. Like, when it's like, you know, the Singapore sling, I'm like, I don't have the stuff to make that. Also, grow up. I'm just kidding. I'm like always like, how do you know what that is? But the thing is like, in my environment personally, it is a lot of Tito's soda, Jack and Coke, the basics. But people do order, like, especially with this weird trend of espresso martinis. Like, I don't have an espresso machine, but because that's so popular now, the company got a product, you know, that's, you know, it's made with coffee. It tastes good. We can work with it. But the thing is, it's like I've been bartending coming up on 9 years. We have some bartenders that are a little bit new. Maybe this is their first bartending job. They came in as a barback, learned flair, and they're learning. But also, like, a lot of our guys have worked in fine dining, other casinos, flair bars, places with cocktail menus, and they have all the experience. They know, you know, stuff off the top of their head that they maybe made it once 10 years ago. Like, as bartenders, like, I know you guys know, like, at least for me, I make it once and it's locked in for some weird reason.
Mm-hmm.
But also at the same time, it's like people in Vegas, and I can't stress that enough, it gets very specific to Vegas, and we're really sports heavy at my property. Most people aren't really looking for anything too crazy, but I can speak for myself when I say people just come up like, oh, I didn't get for you guys. What's your favorite thing to make? I hate that question. I'm like, I always say, I go Bud Light in a bottle. Is that what you want? and I'm totally kidding. Like I really value like service and helping people, because a lot of people don't know what they want.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fair. You know, a lot of people visiting, it's their 21st birthday, or they're just a group of people that don't. And they're in Vegas. We want something Vegas-y. And I'm like, Vegas mama? But that's the thing, is like, people will ask, like, can you make me something? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. But like, I'm like, well, what are you in the mood for? Something sweet, not so sweet? Do you want rum, gin, tequila, bourbon? Like, what can I, help me help you a little bit? But that's the thing, is like, oh man, I feel like I went so far away from the question. But yeah, so a lot of us have these skill sets on classic cocktails or creative minds, and it might not be the most like mixology forward, but like, I'll make something super random. People want something sweet with tequila, but not a margarita. I'm like, all right, tequila, peach schnapps, pineapple, and Sprite. Like, like, what is this called? I go, it's nothing. Don't call it anything.
But so what would be some of your go-tos there? So, because it sounds like, yeah, if we're talking about a scenario where you don't have a menu, but I'm sure this has led you and many within the flair field to have these kind of templates in your mind where it's like, sweet might mean this, or like, do you have like a template where it comes to kind of like two of base spirit and one of this and one of that or whatnot?
Sure,
and do you have those already kind of locked in? Like, even if there's not a menu, you already have a menu in your head of your go-tos. Is that kind of how it would work?
Yeah, it definitely works like that. And a lot of times, like, it might be, you know, super basic for us as a bartender and someone who does know how to make really nice craft cocktails. But with these, you know, clientele, you do have to, like, make it seem cool to them. When to us, it's like, people will be like, I want something really sweet and fruity. And I'm like, cool, I'm going to make you a Bahama Mama. And they'll be like, ooh, like, what is? Like, and it makes it look, because I'm putting multiple things in it. And to them, it looks like they got a cool Vegas-y drink. But to me, I'm like, yeah, it's just, you know, ABC, and it's super basic and easy. It's kind of like you want them to think that they're getting something, like, crafty or, like, different or interesting. And sometimes I'll go like classic cocktail, or it'll just be so basic, but it'll just look kind of cool. Or if people want something like with gin, and I know for all the bartenders listening, you know I'm putting Saint Germain in that, because they don't just want a gin and tonic. So I'm going to do like squeeze a few limes and lemons, throw some Saint Germain and gin, shake it, strain it over fresh ice, and do soda 7, whatever. So like my bartender friend, like we all know like that's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But to them, it's like, ooh, like a craft drink. So like, we're kind of like not messing with them, but like from our perspective, we know that it's not like anything that creative or cool, because like I was telling you earlier, like I've been to these like amazing craft cocktail lounges where like that's the whole premise, is they come up and they ask like, what spirit do you like? What flavor profile? What are we in the mood for? And then they come up with some amazing creation. And I'm like, I'm kind of like doing a fake version of that with
working with
what I got. I
wouldn't say
that
it is a fake version. I would say that you're doing exactly the same thing there. You know, like, you know, that is the model that was kind of, pioneered by Milk and Honey, which later became Attaboy. And, you know, like that's what Attaboy does, right? You guys are doing exactly the same thing. I would say that perhaps the ingredients that you're using maybe are slightly different by the sounds of it.
Yeah.
And also maybe the clientele, no, not even the clientele, the expectations of the guests are
100%.
Different, right?
Yeah, that's a really perfect way of putting that. I absolutely agree, because it's, you know, I don't have like nice fresh juice. I mean, it's off the gun, and I'll squeeze lemon and lime when I can. But yeah, there's not a whole lot to work with, so we do what we can.
Mm-hmm.
Some bartenders might not put that much into it, and they'll be like, "So a vodka cranberry?" I'm like, "Come on, guys! Like,
yeah.
give them a little bit more." Like, if we're really busy, and people are like, "What do you have?" and I'm like, "So much! I have so many things."
Look at the bar.
And then I was like, "I have almost a full bar. A few things I don't have." They'll be like, "Mojito." I'm like, "I don't have mojito."
Mm-hmm.
Or they'll be, and then whatever else they say, like the few things I don't have, and I'm like, "Let me just, I got you." And they'll be like, "Cool." Most of the time, they trust the bartender. And I can always tell when there's someone in that comes in, whether it's they order just a shot of Fernet, and I'm like, "Where you bartender?" Whatever it is. Or they'll ask, like, you know, do you have A, B, or C? And I'm like, "Oh, no, but I can tell you have good taste. This is what I got to work with that I think you might like."
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the ways here as well? Sorry to interrupt there.
No, please.
I think this goes for any bar around the world, right, where people are... If someone comes from that background of being an enthusiast or working in the industry, they will immediately be able to tell things like, how's this drink going to come out, whether that's via like the ice that someone's using or the amount of ice that someone's using or the technique, or did they pull the vermouth from the fridge or has it been sat in the back bar? Like there's all these immediate signifiers. You're working with an added layer of difficulty here where it's incorporating a very visual aspect into it.
Yeah.
Which is hard for us to kind of portray in the audio medium. Maybe we'll try that in a little bit.
Picture this, guys.
But what are some of the ways, because it's very clear that quality of drink is super important to you as much as the show that's on offer there. So what are some of the things, or what advice would you give to someone getting into it that allows you to ensure that, whether it's maybe to do with those things that we mentioned there, like ice and stuff, or like how do you ensure consistency as well, but also quality of that final drink?
I think a lot of it is it's consistency with every aspect of bartending, because like if you're an incredible flair bartender, but you have no cocktail knowledge and no speed, you're a shit bartender. And we all know that. None of us think that we're like the best because we can flip a few bottles. I mean, that's what I pride myself on, is like, I might not be the best flair bartender in the world, but I'm pretty good at what I do. But I also have the people skills and like speed bartending. And that's another thing about like flair people. A lot of us, like for these jobs, we train and we do speed rounds in competitions and in our level tests. So it does help with that. And it's one of those things, like, you learn on the job as you go, like, just because you're training flair, like, you know when to do it, when to not. You know, service always comes first for us. And that, like, that would be a piece of advice I gave somebody, like, starting off, like, maybe they got hired. And it's like, you have to read the room. And, like, when we're football, Sundays, NFL, like, that's, you know, like I said, Circa's very sports heavy. So, like, we're not doing flair every drink, you know, like, we're still doing, you know, what our turn and burn bartenders are doing. We're doing, you know, four orders at once while catching somebody out, while icing the next order, while greeting another person. Like, we still do that. We might throw a bottle behind our back, like, in the middle of it, but we're not doing it like, all right, showtime. Like, we'll just, we'll be making drinks, and, like, we know people are watching us, so it's just kind of one of those things where it's not adding any time to the service, but it's still, like, you know, people are like, "Oh, like, that was kind of cool," and I'm like, "Thanks," and I'll continue what I'm doing. And then other days when, like, it's groups that, you know, seem interested, or maybe they're like on a club crawl or they're partying, like, you know, then we know to do a little bit longer of a show.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just one of those things that it's, you adapt to it and you kind of like learn. And some people, like, I'll start doing flair and they're not looking up and I'm like, "All right, let me just..."
Yeah, right.
Go fuck myself.
You're not gonna like, yeah, exactly. Like, you're not some kind of that you're like, I cannot make a drink without doing this, right? It's reading the situation,
exactly.
It's reading the guest.
And that's a huge thing people think about flair, is like, yeah, flair bartending is cool and all, but like, I have to do quick service. I'm like, yeah, we do too. Like, I don't know. Maybe, I mean, I'm sure there's us, like, you know, some flair bartenders that don't have that, like, know when to cut off. Like, I'm sure it happens. I've seen it happen. And then some people that maybe, like, don't do it enough. Like, and it's just,
yeah,
everybody's different.
You're always going to get people who are self-indulgent in this space, right? Whether that comes to, you know, a bartender maybe serving a couple who are at the bar and like, completely commanding the conversation and not allowing them to have their own space.
Oh, absolutely.
Or whether it's, right, or whether it's someone who is, maybe spending too much time on flair for themselves, or to maybe for an ego thing versus getting the drinks out fast and well. We did mention that it's going to be very difficult for us to kind of express some of these or highlight some of these visual techniques that we're talking about here. But can you walk us through maybe a handful of them, starting with you know, something that you might learn to do first and then to a real top level technique that you might have perfected for a competition, but you're also pulling out at work.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Talk us through a handful of those.
And I actually do, I teach a beginner class, which it's like a women's only and like also open but not limited to the LGBTQ plus community. Super fun. But like the way I outline, I guess, my class is very like when you're starting off, it's all about your tin. That's like step one. And you want to, a lot of people will try to like, you know, run before they can walk and they'll pick up a bottle of tin. They're like, teach me flair. And I go, no, step back, you know, take a step back. And it's all about gaining the fundamentals, in my opinion, first. And it's holding a tin. It might be, you know, the biggest first one is always just spinning it in your hand. And I always teach people, like, you do a half spin. When you can do that without thinking about it, you do a full spin. And I'll tell people, like, walk around your house while you're watching TV. Just sit there and spinning a tin, because that's just, like, a very, very basic fundamental. And then you might move on to, like, you know, throwing the tin just up and down in front of you, same hand, and then back and forth. And you want to, like, one of the biggest things with flair is muscle memory and knowing, like, your bubble. You know, you don't want to be throwing it, you know, 5 feet in the air. It's you kind of have to find your sweet spot. For me, it's, like, kind of, like, where it crosses, like, my forehead or whatever. So I'll do back and forth, hand to hand. And then you do a single flip. Then you're doing a double flips back and forth in the same hand, because you want to be catching it in the same spot every time. So you're doing a double flip right in front of you over and over again. And then this is always like the turning point where I'll teach my class and I'm like, this seems very stupid and silly. You're just tossing it, you know. And then I'll tell them to, maybe I'll have them pick up a bottle and they'll pour half an ounce in the tin that's in their dominant hand. And I'll be like, okay, set the bottle down and now do that same double toss to your other hand. And they're like, oh, and it's, I'm like, yeah, that's it. You know, same with the, in the same hand, throwing it up and down. And then all you have to do is take a slight step forward and put your hand in the spot behind your back. And then you catch it in the same spot because you're just moving your hand. I mean, of course, there's adjustments, whatever, but all those fundamentals is going to make learning the basics super easy. And also, if you know how to juggle, like I didn't know how to juggle when I started doing flair. And that's like not only helping with like your spatial skills, but eventually when you get to like multiple object moves, knowing how to juggle is already going to be very helpful. So if you're starting, you know, starting off to learn flair, you know, don't try to juggle three bottles, but pick up some tennis balls and, you know, teach yourself how to juggle those. So you have like that little bit of, you know, of a skill set prior to starting. But it's all about starting off with just one mixing tin, maybe one bottle, and you just got to work your way up. Fundamentals are huge, huge, huge. And that's what I always like teach bar backs when they're like, I want to learn that. And they'll pick up a bottle and a tin. And I'm like, well, let's just put the bottle down for now. Or let's put the tin down and I'll teach you how to just toss a bottle up and catch it on the back of your hand, what we call a stall. And just working up from there, building that muscle memory is biggest thing in the beginning stages, in my opinion.
You know, it's fascinating hearing you talk about that. I certainly was drawn to the idea of juggling as you were describing kind of the muscle memory, but also having a reference point for you know, where you're going to be passing a tin and where, you know, practicing the same motion every time,
for sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And building up that. It's also interesting where, and I definitely don't want to say here that we're saying everyone who likes quote-unquote craft cocktails or really well-made cocktails, that every single one of them is either like, you know, looks down on other forms of bartending and things like that. But I'm sure that element exists. And I do find that quite funny because there are even some bars here in New York where they are definitely craft cocktail bars, as we would describe them. And I've seen the bartenders incorporate many of those different things that you were talking about there. I think basically to almost go in the other direction and be like, we're not taking ourselves too seriously either, or we can have a little bit of fun, or we're not, you know, we're not trying to be, you know, looking down or setting too many of these standards. So,
well,
you know,
yeah, and that's sorry to interrupt, but that's a thing I had someone tell me once, because I'm like, I walk into a craft cocktail bar because I enjoy them and I enjoy what they do. But at the same time, like, people will say, I don't want to wait 5 minutes for my drink. I'm like, go to a craft cocktail lounge. And I'm like, I'm not going to say, I'm not, this, you know, it's not a complaint or a diss. It's like, because they're making magic and it takes steps and like whatever that preparation method is for that cocktail. It's like, yeah, like I was telling, when I went to Attaboy in Nashville, it was a phenomenal cocktail lounge. And there was like five of us sat at a table and we waited 20 or so minutes for those five drinks because they were making magic and they were using their skill set to do something incredible. And we're like, we would never say anything about that. But it's so funny, like general public or maybe people in our industry that are like, oh yeah, you like you flare people just want to showboat and take up all this time. And it's like, well, no. Well, sometimes. But like, chill and enjoy. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Or if you hate it, then just tell us. Don't tell us. Just deal with it. But that's the thing that somebody told me once, and I was, you know, we were, you know, having a regular conversation. And I'm like, yeah, I don't get why, like we don't say anything bad about, you know, people with their certain niche or whatever. But people like to talk poorly about us. Not as much anymore. Maybe not at all. I don't know. But it happens.
Yeah.
But we're like, we can do what you guys do at the same time or separately. But y'all can't do what we do, which is not a diss. You don't have to. Like yeah. I said, flair does not make you a good bartender. But it's just a tool in our tool belt.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like, I can only speak for a few of us that, you know, do study craft and mixology. And a lot of us, like competitions have evolved a lot. Now, most of them are, it's like scoring-wise, half flair, half mixology. And we have to make original cocktails, which has been super fun for me because I never, you know, really challenged myself or educated myself. And I have a lot more in the last couple of years, which has been super fun for me. And like, I know now I'm making my own infusions and
oh, nice.
I'm, you know, challenging myself. Like I hate mezcal and I made a phenomenal mezcal cocktail. That's like, you can still get like the smokiness from the mezcal, but like, it's very well rounded. Like, I'm like, ooh, like I made that. That was kind of cool. You know, but there's a lot of us that can do it all.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not always the case, you know.
In the other side of
things. A lot of flair bartenders aren't really, you know, also not knowledgeable on that. But like if I walk into one of the places in Vegas, I could hop behind there and do exactly what you're doing and then some. Come to my place, bring all your ingredients, but can you do that too? And it's, you know, like I said, it's definitely not a diss at all.
Yeah.
It's not everyone's thing. Flair is a lot of time, energy. We're not getting much out of it. I'm just kidding. Like,
no enjoyment, clearly,
yeah,
though.
It's and fun. Also, and it does, like, our tips, it's mm-hmm. very, very clearly higher than at least other places I've worked. I'll just say that.
No, that's as good a reason as any. I'll say that for sure. You hinted upon it here, and this was kind of the final aspect of our conversation that I wanted to get into just a little bit there,
yeah.
Which is, you know, the competitions. We've touched upon some of the things here already today. You talked about the fact that there's kind of timed speed rounds and things like that.
Yeah.
But also that the drink, the final product, is every bit as much a part of the criteria for judging as the technique itself. So can you talk about, yeah, what are those judging criteria? What does that typically look like these days? If you're going to be in a competition, what are the markers you got to hit?
Yeah. So a lot of competitions, and it's not usually this way anymore, but we'll always have like product sponsors, and that's always part of the rules. You have to use sponsored. A very popular one is Finest Call, and you have to do a Finest Call stall, you know, whatever. And that's usually like a separate prize. We love Finest Call. They're awesome. But a lot of it, if it's a competition that the drink is not being tasted, it's going to be very showmanship, smoothness, difficulty, maybe originality. And then there's deductions for drops, spills, breaks, what have you. But it's been evolving a lot. Like I've noticed since I've started doing flair, I can't speak for prior to when I started competing. Now the competitions are very, very mixology heavy. And it'll be, and this is just off the top of the head, like say it's 200 points possible. It's going to be 100 in flair and 100 in your cocktail. And you have to use whatever the sponsor products may be, but it's an original cocktail. And you'll get judged on taste, aroma, presentation, and originality. And it's really cool because the things that we've been seeing on like coming up on stage while doing a whole flair show, we still have the same amount of time. They don't give us extra time because it's a mixology competition too. So we have to cut our show a little bit shorter because we have these really cool like presentations that we're doing. Like, for example, my last one was a board that I made and I decorated it with fresh flowers, made it this really cute thing because I like really floral forward cocktails. And, you know, my glassware had the petals on the side. And I have to use all my fresh ingredients that we have to make and bring ourselves and set up our bar. And we still have the same 5 minutes on stage. And it's really interesting. And it's been, you know, there's some competitors that are like kind of over it and they want to just do flair competitions. There's some people that love that it's split. And I go both ways. I like doing both. It's fun just to go in there and take our Bacardi bottles, fill them with water. We're just flipping, doing whatever. And then we have so much more time for the showmanship. But, you know, it's been a lot more common that it's best of both worlds, which I think is great for us because there comes a point where we do have to prove like, no, like we know how to do cocktails too.
Mm-hmm.
And it adds more stress and work to preparing to a competition, but it is fun. And this is, you know, just specific to me. it's been kind of fun to challenge myself and see what I can do. And like, you know, I'm learning slowly but surely, like pairings and flavor profiles. And I'll be honest, I don't like a lot of liquors. So when I have to do a drink like with mezcal or like a brandy, I'm like, it tastes so yucky. But I have to learn like this actually tastes good to like a more mature palate. But I always like to, you know, put my own twist on things too, because I'm like, yeah, you guys have, you know, your palates and they're very advanced, and I'll taste the cocktail. I did a competition once in Riga, Latvia, and the welcome party was the drink that won, I forget, IBA, the IBA championship cocktail. And I'm like, ooh, like how cute. And I tasted it and I was like, ew, I don't like it. But I have a very immature palate. So it's one of those things.
I'll challenge that notion there. I'm going to come in here and say I challenge that notion. I don't believe in mature or immature palates. I believe in we all have our own palates and we like what we like.
Exactly.
And those can evolve and they don't have to evolve. You know what I mean? No one should feel like under any pressure to do so. But no, it sounds great. It sounds especially that, you know, splitting that between the drink and the technique.
Yeah. It's fun. It's a little extra work. And there's sometimes like we just want to do a competition that's not, and they're not all of us. Some people prefer this way because they're like, we love doing it all. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. It's fun. And then, you know, those competitions that it's just throw down.
Yeah.
Do your craziest stuff that you have to give you time for anything because you're just pouring fake liquor or whatever, whatever sponsor bottle we fill with whatever and doing a finest call mixer and then calling it a day. And then it's based on all flair skill. And some people prefer that. Some people don't dive into the mixology world, which is okay on them. Just why it's okay. The mixologists don't want to flair. Like, we're all family out here. We fam.
There's room
or whatever
for
the kids say.
There.
I don't know. I'm not woke or cool. I don't know.
Lindsay, I got one final question for you here today as part of our regular interview before we move into our weekly recurring questions.
Okay.
I mentioned up top there, not been to Vegas yet myself, but you know, somewhere I really want to check out, and I'm just fascinated by. But it sounds like it's a very unique place to work and be a part of the hospitality industry and making drinks. What would you say is your favorite aspect of that, of being part of the Vegas bartending and flair community? What's the best part of your job?
Yeah, you know, there's so many good things about my job. I mean, you ask any bartender, like obviously we like the money and all that. But beyond like the textbook and whatever you want to consider that, working in Vegas, it's so cool. My favorite part is I meet people from all around the world and the country. Like when I worked on the Strip, I would get, you know, I would see a lot more like other countries. It's because, you know, the Strip is famous. That's where people go. And then transitioning down to Fremont Street, I meet people from all over. I hear different languages, different accents. And I just think it's super cool. And, you know, people always, you know, I get asked the same questions about 15 times a day. You know, where are you from? What do you do? How'd you get here? And I'm like, Ohio, I drove in
job?
My car. I don't know. Yeah. What's your favorite thing about bartending in Vegas?
No.
So you'd think I'd have a quicker answer, right?
No. Hopefully that's not what you get all the time. If it is, I'm sorry. I tried to avoid cliche.
Oh, it's okay. But yeah, I just think it's really cool. You meet people, you hear different stories, different walks of life, and all ages too. Like, you know, 21 and up. But, and it's really interesting. And like one of the favorite things about specific to my bar and my shifts, I get the best of both worlds. I get the fun sports atmosphere. I get the fun tourist vibe, you know, people that are there on vacay. But I also get, we have a lot of locals that come downtown, come to my bar. And I think that's, you know, I choose to be a day shifter. I like that. It coincides well with my hobbies and lifestyle. But that's my favorite. I have the best of all worlds when it comes to bartending. I can just be basic and I'm slinging Tito's and sodas all day. I can make cool cocktails. I can put on shows. I can just hang out. And then, you know, I have so many regulars that aren't, like, even non-local. I have the same people, you know, they have my phone number. They have my Instagram. We talk, you know, I'm coming these days. I'm like, oh, I'll save you a seat at the bar, like, whatever. Like, it's awesome.
Nice.
And it's like the relationships you make with people from not, you know, all of, mostly the United States, but also all over the world. Super cool.
Awesome. That sounds wonderful. Well, you know, I'm going to pull my own seat up at the bar sometime soon. Sometime this year. I'm going to get myself out there to Vegas.
You should. I'll save you a seat in my bar. I gotcha.
Thank you very much. Lindsay, we're gonna transition now to the final questions to finish the show. But before we do so, just want to remind the listeners they can reach out to us at cocktailcollege@vinepair.com. Hey, guys, hit us up with your thoughts. Hit us up with your own flair bartending experience. Maybe you're in a different community that's not Vegas. Maybe there's some other cities. I feel like Miami might be cool. go for that. I think there's a lot of comparisons between Miami and Vegas.
It's a lot. Big Florida community of flair people down there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those guys are awesome.
So yeah, we'd love to hear from you folks and reach out again. Our new email address here. We love to hear from the listeners. But Lindsay, here we are. This is the final order of business for the day.
All right.
Beginning with question number one. What style or category of spirit typically enjoys the most real estate on your back bar?
On my back bar? So at my job, we have, it's pretty equal as far as spirits go. I feel like we have like kind of a plethora of like different whiskeys and bourbons and a couple scotches, but I just feel like I'm trying to picture like there's like, you know, three shelves and like, yeah, quite a few bourbons and whiskey options, handful of tequilas. Yeah, I'd say those.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. I mean,
I think that's fairly consistent with a lot of the answers we get, actually, even though if it's a different style. Yeah, very, very much these days, especially these days with the popularity of bourbon and tequila.
Oh,
for sure.
Absolutely.
Question number two. Well, actually, I'm going to tweak the question slightly here.
Okay.
Which ingredient or tool do you believe to be the most undervalued in a flair bartender's arsenal?
This may sound a little cheesy. Your personality. 100%. That's the most important thing. And that's what I've always, you know, that was some advice given to me starting off, and it's always stuck with me. And I fully agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Personality and, you know, speed. But mostly your personality.
We might have crept into question number three there too as well, which is cool. What's the most important piece of advice you've received while working in this industry?
You know, I think definitely my previous answer is huge. You know, any bartender or flair bartender's most important tool is your personality. Although there's another thing that has always stuck with me that an old school like bartender legend and an instructor for one of our required union port card things in Vegas. And he told us, you know, when people come to your bar to visit, when they leave, they're not going to maybe remember your name, what they drank. They're going to remember how they felt when they left. And that's what's going to get them to come back. Not for that crazy vodka cranberry I made them or that juggle bottle trick I did, but they're going to remember how they felt when they leave. And I think that's, I don't know, that always like stuck with me. I think it's a really cool thing to remember.
That's awesome. Yeah. I love that. Question number four. If you could only visit one last bar in your life, what would it be?
Man, that's a great question. I'm going to be a little cheesy again. So back home in Ohio, my mom and stepdad run a seasonal bar right on the lake. I'd say I go my first bartending job, too, right when I turned 21, assuming, you know, I'd probably go sit there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, have a white claw looking at the lake or something. I don't know. I'd probably say that one.
Nice.
Yeah, home is where the heart is, right?
That's a great answer. All right, final question for you here today.
All right.
If you knew the next cocktail you drank was going to be your last, what would you order or make?
Am I garbage if I say a Truly strawberry lemonade?
Definitely not.
All right, if I had to choose a cocktail, again, I mean, I'm sure y'all might be able to tell by now I'm pretty basic. I love a good Bellini. I love a fresh, nice Bellini. I love that one. It's good. It's tasty.
Awesome.
And I love me a champagne cocktail.
There we go.
If I was going to be a grown-up, I'd say a French 75, I guess.
No, but this is the last one you're drinking. You know what I mean?
All right, Bellini, final answer. Final answer.
There we go. No, you don't need to impress anyone. This is all about yourself. Love it.
I hear all you judging mixologists. I'm just kidding. You guys, we love you guys. I hope you guys love us too.
You can reach Lindsay via Cocktail College at podcast at vinepair.com. No, definitely don't. We don't want to receive any hate mail. That's not the energy we're trying to channel here. Lindsay, any plugs you want to drop right here before we say goodbye?
So you can find me on Instagram at LindsayP440. That's LINDSAY, the letter P as in Paul, I guess, 440. And yeah, keep an eye out. The documentary is called Shaken and Stirred. It'll be coming out sometime this year. They have an Instagram page as well. It'll be in link in the bio. And if you have Hulu Live, I'm also on the first episode of Stone Cold Takes on America, episode one, season one. So check us out. Doing some flair bartending there as well.
I think I saw that one on your Instagram.
Yeah, super fun.
Love me some Austin 316 right there.
Oh, yeah. Stone Cold said so. I had to Google that before I filmed
really?
It. I'm not going to lie.
I grew up in the 90s. Stone Cold was a big part of my life.
He was awesome, though. Gentle giant. He's a great guy. But yeah, follow me on Instagram. Send me a DM. If you guys have any questions, if you want to move to Vegas or bartending or flair or you want to tell me I'm annoying, I don't know.
Lindsay, Thanks so much for taking time out of your trip here to New York to join us in the studio today. It's been a real blast.
Yeah, I've had so much fun. I really appreciate you having me on.
Cheers. Until next time.
Until next time. I'll be back. I love this city.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Cocktail College podcast. If you enjoy listening to the show anywhere near as much as we enjoy making it, go ahead and hit subscribe and please leave a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts, whether that's Apple, Spotify, or Stitcher. And please tell your friends. Now for the credits. Cocktail College is recorded in New York City and produced by myself and Darby Seaside, who also composed our awesome theme music. Just give that a listen. I also want to give a huge shout out to everyone on the VinePair team, especially co-founders Adam Teeter and Josh Malin, editor-in-chief Joanna Sherino, and art director Danielle Greenberg, who designed our killer logo. Finally, thank you, listener, for making it this far and for giving this whole thing a purpose. Until next time. Cocktail College is brought to you by Ketel One Vodka. Certain brands out there, certain vodka brands, want you to believe that these spirits should be flavorless and odorless. And they achieve this profile through multiple runs of distillation in column stills. They actually celebrate this thing. They market it. But you're a discerning drinker, Cocktail College listener, aren't you? And you know that vodka should have character, should have subtle character. And that arrives from the base ingredient and the production technique. In the case of Ketel One, we're talking about a wheat base made using a blend or a mix of pot and column still distillation. And what you get there is character, but subtle character, so that it's going to enhance but never overpower your favorite vodka cocktails, your martinis, your cosmos. Ketel One stands so firmly behind this production technique that on every single bottle, there's an invitation for you, the drinker, to visit them at their Netherlands distillery. And hey, why wouldn't they? They've only got 330 years family distilling experience right there. So it's understandable that they back themselves. And you should back them too, listener. You know what you should do? You should pick up a bottle and head over to KettleOne.com to learn more.